Bandwidth for the Weird Things podcast provided by WiredTree. For sites of any size and world-class customer service, head on over to WiredTree.com.
Ladies and gentlemen, welcome to the After Things podcast. I'm Andrew Main, joined by the regular crew, Brian Brushwood.
Yo, yo, yo.
Justin Robert Young.
Good day, friends.
And we have two special guests here today. We're going to be talking about the debut of J.F. Dubose's book, The Life Engineered. And I brought along here Mr. Peter J. Wax, who's the managing editor of Wordfire Press, which is the with Kevin J. Anderson, a big imprint that represents how many authors?
78 authors.
78 authors. He's a writer. He's a publisher. He's done a lot of different, you know, areas in that. Very active in many of the conventions you're between. You're stopping by Gallifrey. You're going off to
PensaCon in Pensacola, Florida, this coming Thursday. We're doing something like 30 Comic Cons this year.
So what we thought was great is that here we have JF, who's got a new book out, who is out promoting it and working with Inkshares, which is a very interesting, exciting platform. Is that we can dissect his approach of how he got to where he is right now, what he plans to go doing as far as promoting his book, maybe get some insight from Peter as far as some suggestions, some advice, and maybe we'll ask questions back and forth. So does that sound good? We wanted to do the ultimate weird tank for JF, so I brought in somebody who's been instrumental in helping develop and promote hundreds of books for many, many, many authors, and so it's for you, JF.
It's perfect because I need all the help I can get.
So the question that I wanted to ask during Weird Things, but felt like it belonged here, is could you real quick give us the thumbnail sketch of like how far – this is your first novel, right?
This is the first novel I'm actually publishing. I've gone through what I would call practice by writing maybe another five novel total. But this is maybe the second one I'm trying to actually push. The first one I'm doing the traditional publishing thing, so I'm not really talking about it right now. I'm not promoting that, but this is the first one that that's actually getting published professionally.
Wait, time out, hold up. You just said you wrote five other novels, mm-hmm. And this is the first one you put out there. So what you're saying is you're not rushing to put out the first thing that came out of your computer, your keyboard, out in front of people. That you bid your time. That you said, all right, this is the one I feel comfortable doing that with.
Yeah, because mostly the first one was garbage, as any first sketch you'd assume would be. So that one will never see the light of day. It's a terrible, terrible vampire book that I hate.
I think that's great that you did that. I've done that. I think we've all sort of done that.
It's a truism in the industry that that most authors end up with about 10 novels in their trunk, just ready to be burned before they've got the one that they're ready to shop. It was Theodore Sturgeon in the 80s, I believe, that said, you're going to write a million words of complete crap before you're ready to sell professional work.
It's a very important point. One of the problems we have in trying to help our work with other writers is we get people who've written one book and they want to go out there, you know, guns blazing and promote it and sell it to the world. And they're understandably proud of the fact that they wrote a book, which you should be to go through that level to do that. But it may not be as good as the next book they write, and to put that effort into sometimes they put a lot of effort into something that's not really good, there might be great elements to it, and they become discouraged. Where you, Jeff, as you said, hey, I'm going to write a few books, maybe this one will be it, each time you learn from it. And so that's lesson number one. That is a great lesson that we picked up from you here.
Well, it's a benefit of coming from a creative background as a graphic artist. You never sell your first sketch to a client. And the way I approach writing when I started thinking of a writing career and that I wanted to do this more and more, there was no way the first thing I did would be good enough. And I mean, I could polish the turd until it shined. It would still be crap. So I have some friends that have been writing the same book over and over and over again, trying to perfect it over 10 years. I'd rather write 10 books over 10 years and get better with each iteration, because that's usually how most artistic endeavors function.
It's funny because I find that directly translates. Early on, I did a magic show performing as a magic duo, and there was a philosophical difference that ultimately we split apart. And really, it was because
Brian.
Wanted to, not Andrew Main, but he wanted to perfect everything. He wanted wanted to sit there and rewrite and rewrite and practice in the living room until it was perfect and then present it fully formed to the world. And I never believed for a second that that was the way to, if you want to get good at performing on stage in front of a real crowd, the only way to get there is to perform on stage for a real crowd and to suffer the slings and arrows of, you know, people throwing fruit at your stage. Not that I'm bitter, West Virginia, and figure out what lessons you can take away from all of that. And in your case, you know, if what you want to do is write a good book, you got to write the entire book. You don't sit there and hold your first book close to your chest and just keep rubbing it, hoping it'll get better and better. You're like, okay, that's it. Now let's do the next one. And, you know, you write 10 books and then the 10th one turns out you're pretty good.
So you have this book and then the Sword and Laser, explain to us the Sword and Laser competition and how you came into this.
So I'm an avid podcast listener. In fact, maybe I have a condition where I listen to a lot of podcasts, and I listened to this Sword and Laser podcast, and at some point they were mentioning this Inkshares thing. And I had already self-published semi-successfully a first version that friends had helped me edit. Like, I have a friend who's a professional developmental editor, and she helped me polish the story as best as she could for free. And I had someone else help me do a proofreading. So I had self-published a book and put it on as a Kindle book. And on occasion, I was giving it for free through a Kindle, one of the offers that they do, Select, I think. And it was getting okay reviews, which was surprising and heartening. But when the Inkshare things came up on Sword and Laser, which was it was essentially a contest, being a huge fan of Sword and Laser, I thought to myself, man, it would be kind of awesome to have this level of validation and go through what Inkshare promises to be a much more professional and real editing process, if you will. Not that I want to put my friend down, but she was doing this pro bono, so, you know.
Well, let's explain the way the Inkshares process works, because I think this is probably new to most people, what Inkshares is.
Do you want me to go through it?
You would have a better, more...
So the way Inkshares works, initially it was very much meant to be a crowd-funded publishing platform. The way it's evolved, it feels more like a crowd-voting platform. The way it works is if you have an idea for a book or you have a book that's written, you can put it on Inkshares for people to pre-order copies. And once you reach certain goals, you can get certain types of publications. There's two basic goals. There's the 250 pre-order that gets you into what they call the Quill Collection, which is a light version of the publication. They let you take care of your cover. They don't do too much developmental editing. They do a bit of proofreading. They have a concern. They want to put out a good product, but at only 250 pre-orders, they kind of budget it a bit tightly for that. If you get to 750 pre-orders, and you have to understand the pre-orders are meant to be backer pre-orders, so they're a bit more expensive, but these are going to be they're going to be numbered, they're going to be signed by the author. So there's a lot of you're not just buying the book, you're buying into supporting the author. And at 750, you get the full Inkshares treatment, where they hand over your book to another company called Girl Friday Production. And these guys are experienced in doing developmental editor. They gave me a developmental editor that was amazing because he understood what I was trying to do with the book. I've worked with other editors before for books, and they wanted more to impose what they thought the story should be instead of working with what the story was meant to be. So they give you a good developmental editor. They go through the entire process. They make you work a lot, which was both tiring but also very reassuring, because I was very worried that Inkshares would just be a crowdfunded vanity press. But no, I haven't gone through, say, what Andrew has gone through working with an actual publisher, but to me this felt very professional.
You've got a number of blurbs from other people about this book, and I would imagine that they've seemed to be very proactive in what they've done to promote, you know, sending books to us, you know, helping organize stuff. From all intents and purposes, you're working with a real publisher, from what I've seen, and a very active publisher.
Yeah, one thing that I came to learn about the economic model behind Inkshares is that the funding that they get from those 750 pre-orders doesn't cover everything. So Inkshares has a vested interest in making sure that the end product is very good. It needs to sell beyond the pre-orders. They can't just sell the pre-orders and then be done with it and cut a profit. If they do that, they have a net loss. So they need to sell beyond that. So there's a lot of pressure on them to make sure that the book, even though it was basically voted into production by outside forces, becomes a quality product. And they have a lot, they have a commitment towards promoting it so that it goes beyond. And the more it sells, obviously, the better for them, better for the author, better for the platform and their credibility.
Yeah, for sure. So you entered it, you submitted it to Sword and Laser to be part of that. And the Sword and Laser, they vote on this? How was that decided?
So basically, what Sword and Laser did is that the top five books with pre-orders would get the full publication, whether they reached their goal or not. Back then the goal was 1,000 pre-orders. Things have changed. They're constantly adjusting the model to sort of fit the needs. But basically, the top five would get publication, and the original idea was that Tom and Veronica from Thorn Laser would pick one of the book to be in the first book in the Thorn Laser collection on Inkshare. What ended up happening is that they took the top six because of reasons, and they picked both a sword selection, which is a fantasy book, and a laser selection, which is a sci-fi book. And my book ended up being the science fiction book that they picked, which was incredibly validating, having people that you look up to and admire and you listen to their product and their fellow creatives decide that of the winners of a contest, like the runners-up of a contest, that your book is the one that they want to put in their collection.
That's extremely flattering, because it's people that, you know, that you share a lot with. It's something when you're from a community and that community recognizes what you've done and they support that and they get behind it. And so, and as part of that, then you worked with Inkshares. And so it's interesting for, you know, until you've done that process, what that's like to have other professional people go in there and tell you, like, hey, you know, the kind of thing I get at HarperCollins is like, I have a fantastic editor there, Hannah Woods, who will send me not just, you know, there's people who actually do proofreading of it, but her job is editorial. You know, we need to, you know, explain this, get into this, things more like that, which is both awesome and it is extremely aggravating, humiliating, and many other painful things when you get a manuscript back where literally every sentence has something redlined under it. And you're like, oh God, this is, but yeah, that's how
and
better things
half
better.
Of it is stuff that you feel that a monkey could have spotted and you missed. And it just feels embarrassing at some point.
Yeah, I'm going through a crowd edit right now on my book Station Breaker, and I have like nearly like 600 or 700 submissions from people, and a lot of them are the same stuff. But you know, you're in, to the credit, most people haven't pointed out that I'm an idiot. But you look at some of the most simple things, like there's no period at the end of the sentence, and you know. But you do get some people like who will. The frustrating thing is when you deal with editors who don't understand what it's like to write something at length. And they will tell you like, well, yeah, you don't know this or you don't know that. Like, no, I do know this. I do know how that word's spelled. But, you know, it was at 3 a.m. when I wrote that, you know, and that gets you have to get over that in order to be able to deal with that. How has that process been for you working with people along those lines?
What was great about working with my editor at Girl Friday, Cleet Smith, is that, like I said, he understood what I was trying to do with the story. So his goal wasn't just to do the job and wasn't just to correct my mistake, but really to take this book and make it as good as possible. So although there was a lot of corrections that one of the examples that felt kind of weird and embarrassing is that he had to point out that I was using the word instinctively everywhere and to maybe look into not doing that. So
that's a common thing, and like I suddenly is one of those Elmore Leonard words you're not supposed to use, but suddenly is actually a good word, I think, with sparingly. And I just did an edit yesterday and I saw suddenly used in one paragraph after another. I used it twice and I'm like, well, that's bad, you know, that's really, really, really bad to do that. But these are things that are inevitable, and every writer goes through that.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah. So yeah. let's talk about your what you're going to do to promote, and then we'll get Peter to weigh in on and thoughts on that. So what's your promotion plan? What is your scheme, JF? Now that you've got this book, now that the hard work is done, so you think, what comes next?
Oh no, I know that writing the book was the fun part and the easy part, and then the road ahead is the hardest. So right now what I'm doing, a lot of what I've been doing is weaseling myself onto podcasts because that's the medium that I'm most familiar with and I feel more comfortable dealing with. So I've been weaseling myself onto popular podcasts to piggyback on their popularity and get a bigger audience. So far it's working okay. I've got a couple of good ones. I've started doing a mailing list today. And one of the things I'm trying to do is I wrote a short story that is happens in the world of The Life Engineered that I am going to publish in a few places that I'm hoping reach an audience that's interested in science fiction, but mostly an audience that is not already the built-in audience that I already have. Because one of the things I've noticed about the way I'm promoting the book so far is I'm staying in a very, very closed echo chamber where I keep re-promoting the book to people who've already bought it, which is not very productive. So I'm trying to reach out. But,
I mean, there is some value to that. What's the old advertising maxim that they need to see the message six times before they actually go for it? So I don't know that it's entirely wasted if you keep showing up in front of the same people to remind them that you have a book.
No, there's definitely value, but they've seen it 60 times by this point. These are people that are, you know, sending me pictures of my book on Twitter. They've seen it. They've read it. These are my people. They're my brand ambassador at this point. So I want to bother them a bit less.
Brand ambassadors, pushing them outwards to create new impressions towards other people.
Correct. Which I'm not super good at doing.
Yeah. So what the question is? What are you doing in that regard?
Well, like I said, I'm right now trying to reach out to certain a few blogs to publish that short story and
What Peter was saying is that I'm going to mansplain for Peter here. Was saying that, like, okay, it's good that your people are overhearing this message over and over again. He says, now, how do you use them as ambassadors? Those people, like, don't be afraid of pushing the message.
How do you get them to? How do you have a plan? And what is that plan to get them to amplify for you and start making sure that all of their friends just go buy the book because they're sick of hearing it 60 times from the friend that is obsessed with it?
I have a half-assed plan in the sense that I don't have a plan to push them into doing it. Where I'm lucky in a sense, well, lucky and unlucky. I'm lucky in the sense that a lot of these people are already doing that, which is great. These are the people that in a way have already helped me win the campaign in the first place. So they've already been doing that a lot. Some of them, a lot of them actually. The rest, however, those that have only bought the book in a fire and forget kind of way, to get them more on board and to make them into better ambassadors, that I don't have a plan.
So we all go through this fear of that we're going to keep if it's the same tweet over and over again, it's a horrible idea. And that's not what you're doing. And we all go through this fear that we're going to keep pushing it. So we saw Daredevil last night. We watched a marketing campaign.
Deadpool.
God.
That's two. Two have fallen now.
Dave Pool, too.
That's right. Ryan and Dave Pool. Three have fallen.
Yes. So we all went. So we watched Deadpool last night. And we went and watched Daredevil afterwards, actually. Back me up, Peter.
Yeah.
Right.
On
the extended Ben Affleck version.
Right.
So we watched Deadpool, and I almost said, Deadpool. We watched the effing movie last night after a big, long campaign that some people thought maybe went over the top or whatever too much, but then we $135 million weekend, it worked. Then immediately, I'm on Rotten Tomatoes seeing how it was doing there. I'm on Variety seeing how I want to see the other parts of the narrative. There's the story of Deadpool, and then there's this other story, this other narrative about it, which is what is the success going? So occasionally, I will tweet out how my book is selling, and I'll do that. I try to invest people in the larger story. So, JF, there's your book, there's the plot, then there's your journey as an author. Where are you appearing? Did you tweet out to people that you were going to be on Weird Things talking about the book?
Yes. Okay. I might have not tweeted out early enough. about it, though.
Well, I mean, but here's, no, here's, but that's here's good. The so thought that's, is that you have these, you know, don't focus so much. At least my thought would be, at least, you know, you there are the people that bought it that haven't read it or might read it. There are people that haven't read it at all and have no idea what it is. Everybody in that chain will be better off and closer to the fan that you want if they see the most hardcore continuing to buzz about it. And I think what Andrew was saying there is, like, if you're continually creating shareable content, messaging, achievements, like literally anything that illustrates you as a likable personality on a journey from guy that they discovered, because of course the idea that somebody's discovered something is very powerful, becoming bigger, better, successful, you know, written about on the blog, or winning an award, having a certain rating on Amazon after a milestone that you can totally invent. That's all a reason just to get in their newsfeed again, to pair bond them to you even more and create more of a buzz. I mean, that's what organic buzz looks like, and that's how it happens.
So I'm going to give you real quick. You say you've inundated them. You got 27 reviews here. You could get a lot more reviews if you motivate them.
And
well, I've been trying. And one of the things I have done is that the people and those 27 reviews were a bit fewer only a week ago. What I've been doing is people that haven't received their copy yet, before they got the digital version, I was sending them, if they would put a review, I was sending them an early version so that they could start reading it and be able to put a review before the official pub date.
Cool.
But if I can do more, I will, if you have recommendations.
So you actually said something in there that I've heard a lot of authors who are in their first few books say, which is that, you know, I'm lucky. The people that like it are getting out there and being vocal for me. But I want to remind you, or maybe show you, that the only difference between a mob and an army is logistics and pitchforks. But the thing is, if you organize them, they will turn into an army for you. And they will like doing that, especially if you have special little treats and things to thank them for helping you grow your career, because they're already invested in you. They already like you. They help you win this Sword and Laser campaign. And they will get behind that organization. So what you need to do is you need to figure out how to actually use them as the army they want to be, instead of letting them just mill around the town square of your book as a mob looking for, you know, beer and Frankenstein.
That's a great way to put it.
That absolutely makes sense. I mean, I'm a huge proponent of being organized and having all my ducks in a row. But that is something that basically it has to do with just overcoming the insecurities of not wanting to impose my will and beg for help. But at the same time, like, I know that people like to help, and I should be, I don't want to say using that, but using that.
Well, but you know, you think of it like this. You know, it's like a party. Nobody wants to be at a party where the person hosting it is like, well, you know, geez, parties, I hate them. It's so awkward to talk to people. And, you know, you want to be at a party where the host of it is having fun, and then everybody else can follow suit. So in a lot of ways, yeah, listen, it's a huge hill to conquer to not, you know, you want to, you know, be like, oh, well, I'm humble and I don't want to appear megalomaniacal and thinking that this is all about me and yada, yada, yada. But at the same time, the product and people's love of it needs to be cultivated. And if you are not actively doing that for them or helping to play your part, because they are always going to look to you to be how excited they should be publicly on it, then you're effectively saying the opposite. You are sending an active signal that maybe you shouldn't be that excited about it. You know, maybe it is just something that you don't want out there all that much.
No, and that's an excellent point. And the weird thing is, this is exactly the kind of speech that I keep giving other friends that are authors. Like, I have a lot of people, because I was successful in my book campaign, there's a lot of people in the other contests that have come on Inkshares, there are people doing contests that will contact me and say, hey, do you have any tips? And this is exactly the kind of thing I say. Like, one of the the latest Nerdist contest, they asked some of the older some of the other winners that to give their tips. And one of the things I told people is like, don't be ashamed of your book. Like, no one's gonna like a book that the author doesn't like. So love your book and show that love of your book. And then I turn around and do the opposite of what I'm recommending. And that's something I need to get over.
Well, it's tough. It's tough because one of the things you have to get over is the perception that somehow you're cheating. Like we all have this fantasy of you create your art goes out, and then you know, plaudits and awards come raining down upon you, and that is validation that you did a good job. Weirdly. Like, and it's utterly irrational. If a magazine reaches out to me out of the blue saying, hey, we'd like you to, you know, talk about your show a little bit, for some reason that's somehow better than if I send out a mass email to, you know, 1,000 editors saying, hey, would you like to do a feature on my new book or whatever? From a practical standpoint, it does not matter. You got the word out. You communicated effectively. You're now going to reach those same people. One situation is not better than the other. And if you can learn to, yes, try to get your book into other people's hands and feel good about, like, even though you know the exact lineage of who talked to who to get, you know, your face on this magazine, that in no way reduces the accomplishment.
And on the whole, you know, I was lucky enough thing, I'm actually going to steal a little speech from James Artemis Owen right now. He talks about Eggs Benedict, and he says, when you walk into a breakfast place and say, so how are the Eggs Benedict today? The waiter or waitress doesn't look at you and say, well, you know, the cook put a lot of work into it, and it's got potential, and I don't know, if you order it, you might like it, and maybe you could leave a review on Yelp. No, the waiter says, best damn Eggs Benedict you're ever going to have, you should order it.
It reminds me of, if you haven't read it, Six Harsh Truths. In fact, that'll be my pick for After Things, is just type in those words into Google, and it'll lead you to a cracked article from the guy who writes under the name David Wong. It's wonderful. He makes a similar parallel when he talks about you know, your wife is choking, somebody walks over and wants to do an emergency tracheotomy, and you ask him, are you a doctor? You don't want to hear about how hard he's worked at this, how much it means to him, how deeply he cares about it. You only want to know, is he qualified to cut a hole in your wife's throat to save her life? And so you only matter insofar as what you have to offer other people.
Well, yeah, let me also just David Wong article on Cracked, I've read it.
Let me illustrate this, because I think that this might be part of it for you, JF, is it's far easier when somebody else sets a goal that you have to conquer. Now, that's its own challenge, and you have to get over your own elements of self-promotion, but what you had was a definable goal set up by somebody else. And in this case, it was Inkshares. It could have been space aliens, right? We needed to get from here to here, and I need to marshal enough support so I am the number one in this category. Once you're past that, that's really where the challenge begins, you know? And it's a lot of the same stuff that I've faced now with the contender that, you know, we had Kickstarter. Kickstarter was a big thing, and that's a defined goal. That ends after 30 days, right? Then we had all the challenges of getting everything together and finalizing it and getting printed. That's its own set of challenge. But now we have to invent reasons to get out in front of people and say, hey, look, here's a game that you should really buy. We don't have the benefit of a larger institution saying, hey, here's some forced goals that you now need to benefit on top of. And that's the reason why we went out to Iowa and New Hampshire, and we're doing a bunch of other stuff where, you know, we're going, you know, where every Friday and Saturday we're retweeting pictures of people playing the game, because we need to, if we don't invent these reasons to go and talk to people about it, to get people excited about it, then that's the, what else do we have? You know, there's just no other reason. It's what Brian has done expertly on Scam Stuff. Scam Stuff has a weekly event that is new product, right? And the pageantry that is put around that is enough to at least command people's eyeballs on a mailing list to say, oh, crap, that might be something I want.
Well, and that's the incredibly surprising thing for me, is that we'll do a new release that, you know, and some products do well, some products do less well, but we always try to make the email entertaining and engaging. And sometimes we'll see a giant spike in sales. None of it for the new product. It's as though just knocking on their door and saying, like, by the way, party's still rolling over here. There's lots of rad stuff. This is the newest thing we're all talking about. And you're like, well, I don't want the new thing. I want this other stuff that I remember hearing five times about before.
Those are both excellent points. And so, it's a question of applying it that I need to really get off my ass and do.
Well, yeah, and we go around the clock. We're all in the same spot you're in, and in the same thing, telling people you should do this, and then it's easy for us to tell somebody else what to do. So Peter's here. Peter is super active in the con circuit, super, super active in the con circuit. And when WordFire Press does their booths at conventions, they were at Dragon Con. Mm-hmm. At the same time, we were at Dragon Con. Huge, 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 huge lines. You just did one, Reed, something you set up, like something like 2,000 autographs or two, what was the?
Oh, no, that's a small show for us. Our record show right now is over 10,000 autographs. We had lines stretching from one end of the vendor hall, slicing across all of the vendors under the green room, which most of the writers weren't allowed access to, and back across Celebrity Row, and we cut off all the actor lines just to be dicks and show them that authors are important too.
That must have been very well received.
So, tell us I've never brought a book to a con. I've been a guest at a con, but I've never presented. Never done book signings at con. I've done. I mean, it's not a genre con. You know, I've done like other stuff like that. That's a very new sort of novel area for me. It's something I want to get more into. It's something that is JF's career. JF is planning a career as a writer of not just, hey, I did one book, slap myself back. He's got more doing. He's working with a traditional publisher in his next project and building out there. What advice do you have for getting into that?
Okay, so, there's actually two avenues that you should be looking at. Any physical interaction is a chance to shake someone's hand and know whether or not they're going to end up being a true fan. And true fans are the ones who you can organize, who you can turn into that army because they're eager to help you. So getting to meet them and take their measure and let them take your measure is a wonderful, amazing thing. There are two paths that I have personally set on following through with that. Before WordFire Press, I actually decided that I needed to either be a novelty item in a non-traditional place with my book, or I needed to be the best of the traditional items in the traditional place, which is where our Comic-Con strategy came from. Just the really quick touch point on the non-conventional places and a novelty item. I had a time travel murder mystery, so I called around to all of the dinner theaters and I said, hey guys, I will give you free labor. I'll help set up and tear down for your show every night if you let me have a table off to the side so that people can buy my book as they're coming in for dinner theater.
Wow.
Bam. I was selling 75, 100 copies a night.
Oh, my goodness.
So, finding little places that you can sync up and be a novelty item can be really worthwhile, and you start to develop the fans off of that. But the thing that's going to make shockwaves and buzz shockwaves and get other people tweeting and posting on their social media is getting into the conventions. The speculative fiction conventions, the Comic-Cons, the game shows, things like that, anywhere where they push sci-fi, you have to be a value add because the conventions don't make money off of you the same way that they would off of an actor. So you have to bring a big value add, either in strength of social media or in award-winning or nominated content, which you have an award-winning book, and you can really push that. Don't be afraid to just, you're a writer, make your one sheet absolutely over the top amazing. You know, you won the internationally acclaimed, and I'm sure that there is at least one follower of that contest in another country. So you won an internationally acclaimed contest. Well, okay, convention's going to go, well, that's cool. And they're going to go check out the stats on the blog and on Sword and Laser and on the contest and, you know, start to put those pieces through. You do want to do your best to get into panels. Have you done a lot of panels in the past? You said that you already came from creative and art.
Yeah, I haven't done that many panels. I'm my professional vocation right now is graphic design and marketing. The one thing I have done sort of to get into a bit of practice is I've been volunteering to on panels. Basically, here's a good example of something I did in during the fall. I didn't have a product to sell yet except do some basic promotion for the, you know, the release of the book, but too much in advance, if you will. But I took it as practice where I went to CanCon, which is a speculative literature convention in Ottawa, and volunteered to do a panel on crowdfunded publishing because that was my quote-unquote area of expertise as someone who had done it once. But they built the panel. They found some volunteers and other people to attend. It wasn't a huge panel, but it was a good way of getting like my feet wet and trying to do that. And this is the kind of thing tell me if it's a good idea, if I should keep going or canceling, but basically trying to weasel my way into these kind of panels and like maybe I talk to people at DragonCon, see if they have crowdfunded or any kind of panels where I could be in attendance.
DragonCon is a difficult one. It is one of the oldest ones around. It is one of the most attended, the most controlled. They do as many pro badges out as San Diego Comic-Con. Stacey, I'm actually going to get to that because that's really important, that comment there. Weaseling in, the easiest way to weasel in is weaseling. You're starting to develop friends. You're starting to be part of a network of authors, of bloggers, of podcasters, of the people around you who are in science fiction, in fantasy, who have a love of creation. As you make those friends who have successes and who have access to those panels and to the events in these various shows, just say, hey, I'm ready to start. I'm ready. And they're going to pay it forward and say, okay, well, let me see if I can get you on my panel and I'll talk to the convention. And then you just have to remember, don't be an asshat. Pay it forward once you have the power to do the same. It is absolutely a good, viable strategy, and it's a great way to sell books. People like listening to you. If they sit all the way through the panel and they like you, they're going to come talk to you. And it's another chance to connect and meet people before they take the risk of investing money in your book. So on the community, there was a note on community that I wanted to jump over to really quickly.
Yeah, this is Stacy says, I wonder how important it is to create a sense of community. I know for me personally, half the reason why I'm part of Diamond Club and everything related to it is because I like being part of a group of people that I have things in common with.
Absolutely. And the extant authors that have amazing beta groups that get out there and push are actually mostly in romance. The biggest push groups are in romance. The biggest beta groups, alpha groups, marketing groups of fans come from romance because romance readers talk to each other and they form communities around the authors that they like. So anything that you can do, I've always thought that they have some of the most successful models in romance so far as how the fans can interact and just get rabid about the things they love. So I highly recommend what Stacey was asking about there. Do your best to encourage, give them a platform to talk to each other so that they can support each other and help each other support you.
Yeah, that makes sense.
You can also look into, when Peter brought up the idea of the dinner theater thing, of a way to reach other people, you might be able to contact your local science museum and say, hey, I would like to do, can I put together a session, bring in a roboticist or an AI person and bring in some interesting people to talk about the future of AI or future of this or whatever. There's some sort of sciencey sort of festival or something. Think about going into those areas because you have a very pro, you know, because you're a traitor to humanity, you have a very pro AI approach in your book to that, and that could be something you could talk about at length. I went to an event on Thursday at the Fox Studios lot because they're trying to promote The Martian for award season. So they had in the morning, they had Adam Savage hosting a session with a bunch of NASA astronauts, and they included NASA people, NASA astronaut. Then they had Neil Gershenfeld from the Center of Bits and Atoms at MIT, who's like a super engineering geek hero of mine. Then they had Bill Nye, the science guy, was hosting a session, sat on a session. You then had a session with Ridley Scott, Andy Weir, and Drew Goddard talking about making The Martian. It was a huge event that they obviously, Fox, went to a great effort to put on to promote a movie, because award season's coming around and they know if they get those awards, it's going to increase the video sales, it's going to bring more money, it's going to bring more prestige and all that. And you can do that on a small scale, whether it's a booth at a dinner theater, looking to see around you. I would, again, because there's a sci-fi angle, it might be kind of curious to say, like, man, what could you get a table at some sort of, you know, science museum or festival or meetup or something like that, because you will get the same. You look, where do you see people wearing Harry Potter shirts, Doctor Who scarves, and other sci-fi Absolutely. Tropes? Where else do they congregate besides conventions? And there are a lot of places, and they're looking for that. And sometimes the advantage can be is if you're the one guy from their world that's not like everything else there, you stand out even more, which touched on his thing about being the outsider.
Yeah, that's an excellent point. This is the kind of thing where I need to develop the thought processes to better exploit these things, because I do know a couple of people that work at the robotics labs at McGill University in Montreal, and these are people that I could easily see about, like, what kind of events these guys do.
And you might even think about doing that at a comic book shop. If you've got a friendly comic book shop, if you start, and I think that's one of those, is like, when I see comic book shops that don't do events, and part of the problem is, right, like, we're going to do a sign. Or like, yeah, but do something for something to go to that'd be interesting. If you did a thing like, you know, will AI destroy us or be our liberators, and bring your friends from the people from the same university that killed Houdini, I think that's great.
Do a simultaneous broadcast live event from a comic shop. See if you can get the guys who are working on Android Dick. Oh, my God. You would get that. That would be so amazing, right?
I don't know what that is.
Is that Android Detective? Android Dick? Or is that
it's the Android that looks like Philip K. Dick.
Oh, yeah. I saw him. Yeah, he didn't look nothing right. like... I actually was at a conference and I saw him look nothing like Philip K. Dick. It was, he's gotten better.
Oh, my God. Yeah, that's amazing. Sorry, that stunned silence was us seeing question. Video of Android Dick. That's amazing.
Oh, my God. Yeah, that's... I mean, Uncanny Valley.
See, okay, this is why people believe in murder bots.
Yeah, right? Exactly.
Well, yeah, you know, I mean, Android Dick cracking the joke about petting the humans once the robots have taken over, and you know, you've got an in there, especially with your content in Life Engineered.
But you know, like everything that has been brought up, they're all events, right? They're all things. They're all something that you can go out in your audience and talk about in its idea concept. Hey guys, I'm thinking about doing blank. What do you think? In the book, hey, we booked it. Get excited about it. In the pre-prep, where I'm heading out, everybody, who's going to meet me there? The event stuff and then the aftermath. Those are five different stages for literally everything that you're going to do, in which you have a reason to talk to your audience that's already engaged and has shareable content where they want to go talk to their friends about it. That doesn't involve you just saying, hey, I wrote a book. Buy it? ? You know, it's just a whole other way so for you to interact.
No, that makes sense. It goes back to just the idea of repeating the message until it gets assimilated, and having other people repeat your message until other people assimilate it, et cetera, et cetera.
And using a little bit of, you know, evolutionary process and altering the message a little bit each time and changing the narrative a little bit, because the fear we have is that We know our meta message is buy my book, and we're afraid of telling people buy my book. But if you have something interesting to talk about, and that's a thing that I'm evolving for me, is like with my mailing list, is I start off with, hey, I have a book coming, and then hey, I have anybody want to help me edit this book? Let me know, and I'll let you edit the book. And I get tons of people who want to edit the book, and I get early readers, and then I use that as kind of intelligence to figure out how it's going to be reacted, whatever. And then the next message is going to be like, hey, the book is finished, and if you want to buy the book, you can buy the book. And like, hey, a lot of people love the book, and they're telling people on Amazon how much they love the book. And then if that'd be great if you did that too, if you liked it. And it becomes, hey, look, it's charting really well on Amazon. And I've been doing that with How to Write a Novella, because that's been still hovering around the number one. And so I need to figure out a different narrative for that, but that's got its own momentum, and now I'm going to apply that to Station Breaker. But it's evolving. But you know, as Justin points out, the five stages, not unlike cancer, that you have to promote and keep moving things through.
No, it absolutely makes sense. And there's some of the things that were discussed, example, like setting up an event at a comic book shop. I have an event coming up at a comic book shop that I didn't know exactly how to frame, what to do. You know, what do I do once I'm there? And some of the ideas have been bounced around or certainly serving as inspiration as to what I can actually do that will be more interesting than just, hey, come and see this author tell you to buy a book. Yeah. But actually giving them an incentive to be there and ask questions, interact with them so that buying the book becomes an artifact of the event rather than the only reason to be there.
I've had for my publisher, they've had me go do book signings that have been like, nobody showed up because nobody knew who I was. And somebody walking in there, why would they go there to go do that? Versus, you know, when I've organized stuff at magic shops or other places and I'm like, well, come here for this reason, fill them out through the doors. And I'm trying to apply that model now into publishing. And I'd love to find out if you try to stage it like a mini lecture presentation or something along those lines, come back and tell us. Tell us how that turned out, because this is useful information.
And that is actually something that we do at the WordFire booth. Andrew was talking about these booths that we set up. They're literally 30 feet tall. They're 400 to 800 square feet. We make a big deal out of it, but we focus on, rather than the point of selling the book, we focus on the conversation with the author and on getting photo ops with authors. And then buying the book it's just a byproduct. It's something to hold in the photo or something to get signed. But the big thing is you get to talk to this cool person who wrote a book.
Well, because you guys really, really have it down to a science. And I was lucky enough to see your booth at Dragon Con. But just to give it a sense, you know, it towers above everything else. It just is this mountain of books, like physically, like books just seem, you know, like they're pouring out of everywhere. But it's ultimately designed, and I'm sure through trial and error, to just be a constant crowd magnet, like that it is very accessible. It's not like everybody's leading toward one point. Like there's just as many people that can crowd around. And that, of course, means more people crowd around because they see people crowded around the entire booth.
Exactly. And we hand off to each other. Or, you know, somebody comes up and says, oh, I like urban fantasy. Well, let me take you over to Larry Correa. Oh, you know, hey, I'm a pacifist. Let me take you over to Kerry Vaughn. It depends on what people are aiming for. Yep, there we go, the WordFire booth.
We have a photo up there for audio listeners showing the booth with these very big towering banners. They have, you know, Kevin J. Anderson III has written the Dune, you know, the all the subsequent Dune books. Sarah Hoyt, I mean, just a great – and the amount of talent and people they accumulate in whatever. And that's also the building playing off of each other, is that using Kevin J.'s name to help other people and reinforce, and it keeps everybody relevant. And that's the beauty of, you know – Jeff, start finding your buddies up there in the Great White North.
That is the big thing, is finding the network, finding those people around you, because we started as a hub in Colorado, but now we're across the country. Wherever a con wants us to be, we have local authors who are part of our team, and we're all going to be supporting each other. And that mutual support is a secondary community as opposed to the fan community that's going to be just invaluable in helping you.
No, I think it would be valuable.
Interesting.
Well, that's as good of a place as any to end. You know, an awkward, invaluable correction.
Yes.
Well, you know, all the night long when we're watching Daredevil, I kept telling him,
Jeez. JF, is there anything you want to?
You were correct. I tried to dumb it down, and then it just got dumbed down way further than I intended.
Subterranean levels.
Yeah. Mission accomplished.
JF, do you have any questions or thoughts or anything that you want to bring up?
No, actually, this has been like a very, very useful fount of information and tips and ideas on how to, because one of the things that I've been running into is how to go beyond what I know how to do. Like I was already aware that I need to get over my issues of self-confidence regarding the book and start saying, this is a good book, I love my book, you will love my book, buy my book. But how to basically go beyond that and do more with the events that I am handed, and how to capitalize more on my community, help build my community. And these have been tips that I think will help me. At least it's already given me ideas just listening and talking to you guys. And I'm sure, like, giving it a couple more days of reflection, I'm going to be able to build something a lot more coherent, especially with some of the events I have coming up, to make him more. And this brings it back to what you were saying earlier, make it more of an organized effort instead of just throwing things here and there and hoping something sticks.
Absolutely.
And I think our listeners out there, if you tune into Weird Things, you already know this, but we're going to read it again for the After Things listeners, is you can help JF and you can follow along on what's going on by signing up for his mailing list if you go to bit.ly/lifeengineered. That's bit.ly/lifeengineered. Sign up for his mailing list. They're going to give away 5 free copies of his book. And beyond that is, I'm going to tell you, there's the story there that's waiting for you to happen, the Sword and Laser award-winning story, the internationally acclaimed Sword and Laser Contest award-winning story. And you're going to follow the story of JF as his writing career, his public writing career, gets its start and continues. And you're going to be instrumental in helping him do that. So sign up for the mailing list.
Cool. And I'm actually going to break from what I write in the signing up for my mailing list. And instead of making them as rare as possible, I'm going to do the opposite. I'm going to try to keep people updated on not be afraid, not be shy to tell my story and actually update people whenever there's something interesting going on with the promotion to book or whatever, however my career does build.
I think that's a great idea, and that's something I don't do nearly enough. I had an awesome time spending the day at JPL, and I should have gone on my mailing list and told people about it. The Martian thing I went to would be great, and I think that telling people and how that fits into the narrative, and it doesn't have to be big, lengthy things, but you'd be surprised at how interested people are in that. And yeah, tell them that the story starts now, and they get to be part of it.
That sounds cool. That's definitely something I'm going to take to heart.
All right, let's move on to picks. Do we have any picks? Anybody got a pick? Anybody want to pick something?
Yeah, like I mentioned earlier, that 6 harsh truths that'll make you a better person. Give that a read if you need a kick in the butt. It's pretty good.
Cool.
I'm going to pick scamstuff.com, the number one place where you can find not only magic, but also scam and con-related paraphernalia, a great curation, and an awesome customer experience.
But, all right, there certainly have items. What if I wanted knowledge? What if I wanted, you know, like, I've always wanted to have superhuman strength, and I wanted to really impress people with something. Like, I want to, like, bend an object. Not like a key or a spoon. But what if I wanted to, like, bend, I don't know, a tool, like a wrench?
It seems to me like the only way you'd be able to do that is if you got a hold of, like, the world's only still performing strongman grandmaster, former world champion arm wrestler, Dennis Rogers, and you'd have to catch him at the right time when he's interested in sharing all of his decades-long secrets of how he trains his body to pull off the amazing stunts he did. It just seems like that's a once-in-a-lifetime opportunity, and it's not like, oh, wait! That's exactly what is available right now, is his course, all digital. You could download it and start diving in immediately, available right now at Scam Stuff.
That's great. I'm going to go to the next biker rally and just do that.
So if you're going to bike a rally to try to impress them, try to throw in some taunts. Just, you know, up the ante a bit.
Well, when I pull up my ninja, you know, and get off my little sport bike, my Bryce Rocket, you know.
I think I'm going to go the other way and just try to intimidate Subway sandwich artists and the like. Just really show them who's boss when they, you know, tell me that extra meat's going to be $1 extra.
You're like, you sure about that?
Yeah, it's like, why'd you bring a wrench to a Subway? Like, I don't know. I'm kind of both befuddled and terrified.
Jeff, do you have a pick?
I do have a pick. I have an important pick. Actually, I want people to go visit Inkshares in general, not just my book, but my philosophy is that the rising tide lifts all boats. And as if the Inkshare platform gets more followers, more readers, and becomes a valid marketplace for people who aren't just looking to buy a book, but are looking to invest in an artist and invest in a project as it's being built. Like what you were saying earlier about the basically following not just following the book, but following the story of the authors behind the book. Inkshares is basically where these stories are being told. There are dozens and dozens of authors that are doing great, coming up with really good ideas, and you can follow their stories on Inkshares, preferably mine, but definitely others. if you like anything from autobiographies, there's mysteries, horror, fantasy. They have all sorts of various genres that they're exploring, and this is all from the ground up. This is all from the point where the artist is starting the project, and you can follow their progress and be involved, be part of what they're doing. So if you're not visiting Inkshare, if you're not looking at Inkshare, you really should, because there's definitely something for you there.
think that's right a great on. Suggestion.
Awesome. Okay, so my pick is going to kind of back up the Inkshare thing, but my second favorite book on publishing that I think is an invaluable tool for writers. Second favorite,
it's
of
valuable
course,
too.
Right, yeah. Right. Second favorite after, of course, how to write a novella in 24 hours is Discoverability by Chris Catherine Rush. And it tears apart how indie distribution and even mainstream publishing discovers books and how it pushes through those channels of discoverability to bring a book to a reader. And it is kind of a heavy book to pick up and read, but it has, some amazing stuff in it that will help authors understand their industry a little bit better.
I'm going to go with the pick.
I think I'm going to go pick that up.
I'm going to go with the pick, a movie that I finally watched that's on Netflix right now, and that is Dope, written and directed by Rick Famuyiwa, not a name that I'm comfortable pronouncing, but I'll try nonetheless. And it is a sort of a coming of age tale, a little bit of a life in Inglewood sort of story. Features, I think, a standout cast that we're starting to see in a lot of other movies, and I think Famuyiwa, who also did The Woods, I believe, and some other ones, there's one plot to it that's, kind of like your traditional kind of like how do I fight back against the bad guys sort of thing, but while in the middle of still having to do very evil things or whatever. But I digress. I mean, it involves dope dealing and rooting for kids to successfully dope deal so they don't get killed. But it is a movie, when you're watching a movie that's about kids obsessed with 90s hip-hop culture who have their own punk rock band set in the middle of Inglewood, and it opens up with a kid explaining Bitcoin to his mother, you know you're going to be interesting. Something that
stars Tom Merritt?
Yeah, yes. It does. It's a movie that can, on one hand, drop these disses about Macklemore. You know, somebody's like, well, imagine you're ordering a Macklemore CD from Amazon. He's like, well, I wouldn't be ordering a Macklemore CD from Amazon, and it's like, and then also name checks Aaron Schwartz. I mean, just a across the board, very interesting sort of movie I thought about identity, about defining your own identity and being who what you are, even though there's pressure to not be or conform or do this or whatever else. So I really enjoyed Dope. Thought it was very funny. Again, I thought the cast was fantastic and liked it. So Dope. Dope is my pick. Right, I mean, on. Actual Dope. I'm recommending Dope right now.
By the way, that's the secret to a successful career in self-publishing is just sell drugs on the side. Everything dope, else is a lot easier.
Stop by the word fire booth. Wink, wink. So,
we'll connect you with the right authors.
Yeah. What do you like? You like dragons? Like the dragon? Riding the dragon?
So that's why we have a book about a dragon. Chase that.
Yeah, the books are hollow. He says. Pages are blank.
We let you put the words there.
Yes. It's been after.
Diamond Club hopes you have enjoyed this program.